being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this. I just do.
Book of the Month on Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com. Probably the best download decision you'll ever make.
Hello there. This month's book is Don't Call Me Clyde by Peter Kerr. Peter Kerr's autobiographical tale of the rise and fall of the Clyde Valley Stompers opens in the early 60s as the soon-to-be legendary Cavern Club. Before the Beatles made the venue famous, the Cavern was a jazz club and then a popular place for skiffle groups. The Stompers were one of the biggest names on the circuit, and Kerr, just in his 20s, was the leader and clarinet player. The story follows the band's progress through the trad jazz era to the moment they realised musical tastes had changed and the future belonged to a different genre, the advent of the Beatles.
Yeah, well, this is the start of Don't Call Me Clyde, which is a book that's essentially about my involvement as a jazz musician back in the early 60s. And it goes back a bit further than that to post-war times when I was a kid. And it talks about how people in the austerity hindered years, I suppose you would call them, after the war, how they managed with the lack of money and all these things. We didn't think we were hindered at all. We had a pretty full life. And anyway, I started off as playing bagpipes as a kid. And that eventually, and it's all told in the stories related in Don't Call Me Clyde, I finished up not being a bagpiper, but being a clarinet player with the Clyde Valley Stompers, who were, well, they were actually Scotland's top jazz band back in the 50s. And when I joined them, I think it was 1961. So this is the first chapter of Don't Call Me Clyde, and it's called Down the Stairway to the Stars. Here we go. The Cavern, two white painted words curving above a doorway in the Liverpool back street that struck me as one of the most drab I'd ever laid eyes on. Yet this was the setting of what was to become an icon as far famed and instantly associated with Britain as the Tower of Big Ben itself. Pasted over the graffiti on a brick wall beside the doorway, a poster announced, "Tonight, the Clyde Valley Stompers, Scotland's number one jazz band," and in brackets underneath, "with support group, no name mentioned. 8 p.m, admission £6. So I had a bit of a job to get into the club, because I had gone to park the bandwagon, and when I got back outside the Cavern, the doorman, a big burly Liverpoolian, wouldn't let me in. But eventually I managed to talk him into it, and I went. If the attitude of the doorman had seemed a mite chilly, the same most certainly could not be said for the reception afforded us by the jiving mass crammed into the club that night. The 60s were now getting properly underway, and the young folk of Liverpool were set to make them swing with a vengeance. The Cavern, originally a jazz club when it opened in 1957, had yielded to skiffle during the height of the washboard and tea chest era, was enthusiastically now promoting jazz again. Now, whenever one of the top bands from London was on tour in the northwest of England, Sunday night at the Cavern had become an automatic fixture. Although this policy was soon to be swept away by the biggest sea change ever in popular music, no one could have foreseen that the reason would be a global eruption in the popularity of a bunch of young Liverpool lads who'd cut their musical teeth playing interval spots for jazz bands, of all things. Trad jazz was booming, and jazz bands, for the present at least, were what young people flocked into clubs to dance to. It has to be said, however, that a fair measure of creative license would need to be applied to the word dance by anyone attempting to describe what took place on the floor of the Cavern on a Sunday night. This was a cellar of the low vaulted variety, entered from street level by a narrow stairway which, as far as I could make out, would also serve as the only exit in the event of fire. My first impressions were of a miniature underground station that had been blocked off at both ends, leaving enough room for maybe 100 or so customers to strut their stuff. But the reality was that well upwards of five times that number of determined clubbers would pack in there when a popular band was playing. So anyway, it was very, very tough place to play in. It was a tough place to play in, not because of the reception we got, because it was a Turkish bath, really. And conditions were no better than what passed for a band room. This was nothing more than a small recess at the side of the stage, a depository for outdoor clothes and instrument cases, which had to be shared with the support group. Now, when we came off at interval time, the support group, we had to squeeze past. They were young guys. I think I was 21, and they looked about the same age. And four of them. And all we could do was say, how's it going, and thanks very much, and have a good night, and all that sort of stuff. And there actually was a certain snobbery about jazz musicians as well. We thought ourselves a bit above pop musicians, irrespective of the fact that they might have been better musicians than us. Anyway, the support group, four of them, they squeezed past us. And these four boys may have been unbilled on the poster outside, but the audience were well aware of who they were. And they made their delight at seeing them amply obvious the moment they emerged from the band room. If the roof had hit rafters, the cheering would have brought them down. But that was nothing compared to the noise that accompanied the intro to the group's first song and continued unabated right through to the end of the set. Screaming so loud, it drowned out whatever sounds were blasting from all their amplification gear. Row upon row of girls were working themselves into hysterics in front of the stage, a peppering of boys too. No dancing, no finger popping, just screaming and shouting themselves into a frenzy over a band they couldn't even hear. To a purveyor of acoustic music like myself, this was a disquieting new phenomenon indeed. Could this be the way of things in the future? I mentioned my misgivings to our piano player, Bert Murray, when we were climbing the stairs at the end of the gig. Local band, said Bert, with patent disinterest. You get these over-the-top reactions, probably a setup as well, all stage managed by the club, like it happened way back with Sinatra. Know what I mean? Bert was quite a bit older than me and had been on the road a lot longer. So I respected his opinion, normally. But he must have noticed a look of doubt and expression this time. Nah, don't worry about it, man, he muttered. Tenny penny round here, these beat combos. Electric skiffle groups, I call them. 7 day wonders, here today, gone tomorrow. Who was I to argue? I had a lot to learn.
Don't Call Me Clyde is laced with Kerr's personal story. From his parents' dismay at his career choice, he'll end up in the gutter, to his romance with Ellie, his wife. He relates his early days in the Haddington Boys pipe band, learning to play bagpipes, and fruit picking to pay for his first practice instrument, with wry humour. This taught him to read music and to improvise, playing with his pianist father. Alongside this, he had a fairly typical rural Scottish childhood of the 1950s, helping in the vegetable garden, playing football, army cadet drills, and even the occasional spot of trout poaching. Kerr's ability to summon an era or place is one of his strengths, and he does so throughout this book. Whether he is at a speedway rally or in the cavern as the Beatles play to rapturous applause, his descriptions are both sparse and evocative. He relates the difficulties he encounters with honesty and humour, letting the reader step back into a very different time with ease. His straightforward presentation of life on the road with the Stompers and the impact of great success followed by a mighty fall also makes the whole book very real and easy to relate to.
Now, we had with the Clyde Valley Stompers something of a hit record with a jazzed up version of Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf, produced as it happens by George Martin, who shortly afterwards would gain fame for the work he did with the Beatles. But in this case, in this particular case, as I mentioned in the book, the Beatles took second place to somebody else. And this just happened, this television show that I'm going to describe, it just happened when we had recruited a new drummer to the band, an exceptionally good drummer called Billy Law from Edinburgh. So it was ironic that a drummer of Billy Law's prowess could only appear to be playing on his first engagement with the band. Thank You Lucky Stars was an ITV network programme focusing exclusively on pop singles. A forerunner of the BBC's Top of the Pops, it blazed a trail by featuring recording artists performing their releases live, except they weren't live. And, well, I think that the idea was that the producers of Lucky Stars, as I mentioned here in the book, were leaving nothing to chance and instead insisting on everyone miming to their records. Setting another trend, the show was pre-recorded, allowing for retakes of anything that went drastically wrong. Perhaps not surprisingly, the adrenaline flow of a truly live TV performance was missing, and the hours of hanging about during rehearsals even more tedious. The edition we were appearing in was taped before an audience of mainly teenage girls in the ABC Studio Centre at Teddington, southwest London. And I got the date. It was on Sunday, the 17th of February, 1963. Introduced by Brian Matthew, our old mate, as he called himself, from Saturday Club and Easy Beat radio programmes on the BBC, the show was headlined by Billy Fury, regarded by many as the most authentic of the UK's several Elvis clones. And the programme also featured, now this will test anybody, test the memory of anybody that was around back in 63. The programme also featured Jet Harris and Tony Meehan, late of Cliff Richard's Shadows, Carol Dean, Duffy Power, Billy Davis and the Beatles. But if anyone doubted that Billy Fury was the star attraction, those teenage girls in the audience were ready to convince them otherwise. Mark my words, a middle-aged studio hand said to me just before the videotaping got underway, them silly young bints is going to wet themselves when Fury comes on. No kidding, cock, I've seen it all before, like, and it ain't pleasant having to mop up the results off of the seats afterwards. Billy Fury's fans certainly did plenty of squealing every time he flicked his pelvis during his rendition of, I think it was called, Like I've Never Been Gone, which was in marked contrast to the relative indifference shown to the Beatles' performance of Please Please Me. I recognise that song from somewhere, I marked to Jim Nutz, our banjo player, from a vantage point behind the cameras. Yeah, it's the one you said was a no-hoper when they interviewed in that Roundup telly show in Glasgow, remember? Oh yeah, I do remember it. Yep. And I still don't think it'll be a hit. Little did I know how quickly I'd be made to eat those words. We hadn't really noticed the Beatles all that much during rehearsals. They'd kept themselves to themselves, lounging in a corner, looking slightly jaded. What I did spot, though, was that they seemed to blank Billy Fury any time he came near them. Our in-the-know studio hand wasn't slow to tell me why. They've took the hump because he knocked them back when they'd done a tryout to be his backing band. He shook his head. Nah, load of rubbish, the lot of them. Flashes in the pan, Fury included. Yeah, give me David Whitfield, Joan Regan, Pearl Carr and Terry Johnson. Them's real stars for you. If the soon-to-be Fab Four weren't already miffed by being upstaged by Billy Fury during the show, they certainly would have been by the situation in the car park afterwards. While Billy Fury's limo was being mobbed by dozens of screaming female fans and, fair to say, quite a few male ones as well, the Beatles, unnoticed and alone, were loading their gear into a little Ford Thames delivery van. No wonder the poor sods looked cheesed off all day, John said as he climbed into a comparatively opulent minibus. That's not John and Lennon, by the way. It was John, a trombone player. Imagine having to travel all the way back to Liverpool, cooped up in a windowless little tin can like that. A year or so later, the boys and Aaron and I were sitting up one afternoon in the Waterloo Bar at the end of Princes Street in Edinburgh. We'd been using the first floor function room to rehearse in for some time, and we were in the habit of retiring to the bar afterwards to discuss upcoming dates, although there were precious few to discuss on this occasion. Then the national news came on the telly, which was perched on a shelf behind the bar. The headline showed the Beatles arriving a fortnight earlier in New York's John F. Kennedy Airport for the start of their first US tour. There were long shots and close-ups of the 4,000 screaming fans who had been there to greet them before the cameras panned to a motorcade featuring four lingers, one for each Beatle, heading for the city centre. "No sign of the wee Four Thames van now," said John dryly, harking back to that Thank You Lucky Stars TV show. Well, the Beatles' fortunes and ours had taken diametrically opposed routes since then. But if the start of the present newsreel footage had opened a wound, salt was about to be rubbed in. The TV newscast cast to the present, to London's Heathrow Airport, where the Beatles had just landed following their all-conquering invasion of the USA. According to the commentary, the number of hysterical British fans waiting from there exceeded 10,000. "This is phenomenal," the reporter gasped as the Fab Four descended the plane steps. "Quite unprecedented. No wonder they're saying in America that the Beatles are bigger than anything that's happened in the history of popular music. Bigger than Crosby, bigger than Sinatra, bigger than Elvis. The Beatles' John Lennon even goes further, claiming that the Fab Four are bigger than Jesus Christ." We sat gaping at the TV screen, slack-jawed and utterly bamboozled. "Why them?" said pianist Mike. "Who knows?" said Eddie. "Could it happen to anybody?" said Billy. Like chicken pox." "Take me to a chicken," said the other Mike. "It's the end of the world," moaned Ron. "As we know it," said Jim. "Yeah, as we know it, Daddy." "I didn't say anything. The boys had said it all."
After a period of exceptional success, including a chart-topping record and a number of television appearances, the Clyde Valley Stompers split up, and a number of them morphed into the Pete Kerr's All-Stars in 1963. Tastes were changing, however, and tours became rare, often a series of one-off journeys across the country to isolated venues. Supported by friends and family through the leanest of times, the new band worked as a cooperative, focusing on the music and producing several EP discs. Despite some improvements in their finances, it was obvious there would not be enough work to support them all, and the All Stars finally parted company in 1964. It is a sign of their musical quality that they all found places in highly respectable musical groups. Kerr moved on to beef farming, freelance record production, and was behind the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards' hit single, Amazing Grace. This went on to become the top-selling instrumental single of all time. He combined this with beef and barley farming for some years before moving to Mallorca and farming oranges for a while. During this time, he began writing his mystery books featuring Bob Burns and set on the island. Since returning to Scotland, he has continued to write in a number of genres. Don't Call Me Clyde is more than a book about jazz. It captures an era and highlights the shock and the impact of social change.
And for once, we actually have a musical slicer for the Book of the Month. Not only did we actually hear Peter Kerr doing some readings from the book itself, but we also heard, of course, really one of their major hits from back in the day, the Clyde Valley Stompers and Peter and the Wolf. We may be connecting with Rob Nichols later on in the production, but for now, of course, we turn to Jenny Finch. Jenny, you shared with us some of your thoughts with respect to that side of things. This, for me, was an autobiography which really sets Peter Kerr in an interesting context, because we looked at Jen, a collie's tale that we looked at. We looked at, obviously, his origins in the Mallorca area and other aspects. And I was familiar, clearly, of his work with producing Amazing Grace and the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards. But I find this a fascinating real tale of almost what might have been, insofar as our everybody's life path has got lots of twists and changes, and we never quite kind of see the kind of sense of it. But this was particularly intriguing, and in particular, say, the two excerpts that Peter actually chose, in which it was very much a case of four lads from Liverpool, they're never going to make it, passing fads and all the rest of the bits and pieces. You never quite know, do you, in terms of the artistic world, what's going to be a hit and what's effectively going to be forgotten?
You never do. It's always luck. In anything, in music, in writing, in films, it takes so long to produce something that if you're chasing the latest hit, you're going to miss it. This makes it much harder. Also, a lot of the time, it's outside influences that alter things. A really bad review, something goes wrong at a concert, people who are supposed to support you don't and drop out at the last minute, your publisher goes bust. So many things can affect you. It's a very rocky, rocky road. And all power to him that he kept going and produced so many different things. He obviously has many skills and he's not afraid to use them. Good for him.
Yeah, maybe it's the Scottish background in him in terms of initiative and working through that process. I was particularly fascinated in terms of his own reaction to some of the aspects with clearly the villain of the piece in many ways was one of the original founder members of the Clyde Valley Stompers, who effectively was really just using it as a cash cow to effectively fund his own lifestyle and so on. And I think that's the sort of issue which many people would say, well, hopefully it's gone away now, but it's rather like agencies being sharks and challenges with respect to that. Maybe not so much buyer beware or caveat emptor, but also artist beware in terms of what you're signing up for and what things are actually being mapped out for you.
Absolutely. There are so many stories, particularly from the 60s, but even though people are much more savvy now, it still happens, particularly to young artists, that they're signed up to things and they find that, especially losing control of your own output, it can be devastating. Any artist can just give up at that point if all you've worked for and created has disappeared. It's still there. The whole of this is basically a shark pool, and artists, writers, producers, we're just live bait. And if we're lucky, we avoid the sharks. And if we're not lucky, we get eaten. And nobody protects us, especially not our agents. Sometimes they're the biggest shark of all.
Both of us, and I think Rob too, Rob might be joining us later, and who knows, we might even get a couple of other viewpoints and a kind of serial view of people's thoughts on this. But in terms of the overview of this system, we weren't around really when this book was, when the bulk of this book was being produced. So at least I don't think any of us were really around and on board when we were looking at the time itself. I emerged on the planet in the 60s, but I didn't really have any musical awareness until late 60s, early 70s and so on. Rob certainly is the same and will be with us in a few seconds once he's sorted out his technology, which is always good. Were you familiar with the Clyde Valley Stompers and how big they actually were?
I didn't know how big they actually were, but I as soon as I clicked the YouTube and I heard They're Peter and the Wolf, I knew it. I remembered it. Peter and the Wolf, the original version, was one of the first gramophone records my parents bought for me to listen to. And I was fascinated when I was in a friend's house and they had a television, and this came on the television. I can also remember the rise of the Beatles. I was a mid-50s child, so I was aware of it, but of course not aware of how big they were at that point at all.
Yeah, two lovely tales with respect to the Beatles. We heard really in the readings from Peter a couple of ways in which they were described and the times that they were actually encountered, obviously the connection within the cavern, and also the TV studio, which I find full of laugh out loud moments in terms of the panicky producer and the concerned producer, and of course the way in which the band actually operated, and I suppose really you could say the tensions, the creative tensions between the likes of John, Paul, George and Ringo, Billy Fury, and other characters as well.
Yes, an enormous amount of rivalry more than anything else. I don't think anyone realised just how much of a top dog one particular group were going to be, but everybody was still scrapping for that same thing. And about the only thing the Clyde Valley Stompers had in their favour was there were more of them, and they were Scottish and therefore hard as far as all the Southerners were concerned.
Yeah, I mean, it's intriguing in terms of, again, that particular format, because I'm sure the folk who will be listening to the piece, and again, we might have a little reprise towards the end of the programme, and maybe mourn the passing of this particular area, because it is something which, and in a sense, I'm sure Peter would be interested in terms of sharing his own thoughts on this, or I hope he would be. It almost seems slightly dated. You know, it seems of a particular period where you think, yeah, you know, whereas maybe it's just nostalgia being not what it used to be, but somehow some of the other material that came about in their wake, really, in the wake of the Beatles, etc., still seems to have a connectivity with life in the 21st century. But maybe I'm just being, sort of biased towards the sort of appreciation of the Beatles in that side of things.
I think so, yes. There are a lot of radio stations now dedicated to a particular era, and that helps keep the music alive. I have nephews and nieces who are very familiar with a lot of this music, but they wouldn't know the Clyde Valley Stompers. Almost the Beatles is a kind of Watergate, that a cutoff point. And beyond that, people pick up the major names and sometimes find somebody a bit off the wall that you might have forgotten that they really enjoy. I think going further back, jazz has always been difficult for a lot of people anyway. A lot of people don't like jazz and won't even listen to jazz because they think they're not going to like jazz. It's a much more complex musical form than basic rock and roll, you know, or 12-bar blues. Those are very, very easy to understand and very familiar to us, whereas jazz isn't, and even skiffle isn't really. Skiffle's something a bit, people go, oh, that's weird. Jazz is hard for most people, even trad jazz.
Yeah, Lonnie Donegan and his chewing gum on the bedpost at night, just being one of those aspects. I would have loved to have seen how the Clyde Valley Stompers would have encountered or dealt with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones. That would have been an interesting connection. I would have been intrigued by. So well worth considering. You shared, of course, with us Peter's line of how effectively he negotiated his first musical instruments and so on. And of course, I think that the experiences as a youth were, I think, quite formative in terms of the way in which maybe you said about how he's developed as a fantastic author in his own right over the years. Those formative experiences, perhaps they also provide a certain character building to actually say, well, if you do have to effectively save up and get your first music instrument, it is something that's important, maybe you do tend to appreciate the field much more effectively.
I think in some ways that applies to an awful lot of things. I'm not going to turn into a really old grumpy person and go, we had to earn stuff. But I remember working in shops, picking fruit, working in a factory when I was still at school. And I did it because I wanted to go on a school cruise and my parents couldn't afford it. And I wanted to play the cello. I'm not quite sure why. The cello was bigger than I was, but I had to pay a deposit for the instrument and I had to pay extra to take it on the bus. And I think because of that, I actually stuck with the cello a lot longer than I normally would have done. It does make a difference if you've invested some of your time and effort into it, but times change. Times do change. There was very little extra money floating around then. And you just did what you did. You just did what you had to do. If you wanted stuff, you went out and you hustled for it somehow. That's the way it was.
Indeed, and change in technology also impacts this particular programme's produced. So, I mean, Peter was in Scotland, yourself in Ireland, I'm in the East Midlands, and Robin, of course, sadly unable to connect, although he's trying very hard. He's been trying very hard to actually connect with us. Clearly, he's got one or two challenges with respect to his side as well. So we'll probably, as I say, fit some discussions with Robin later on as a pre-recorded package. Okay, I know it's a biography, autobiography, so it's difficult to actually do this, but were there any characters that stood out for you, Jenny, in terms of actually, yeah, they were my favourite?
Not really. He has a lot of characters in there and a lot of people in there, but his voice is a very strong one and a very reasoned and someone that the readers is going to be very receptive to. It's hard to look past him in some ways, which is what you expect from an autobiography, really. He hasn't villainized anyone apart from one certain member of the band who certainly deserved it and trashed the whole thing. But beyond that, I think he's remarkably even-handed, which makes it difficult to form very strong opinions one way or the other.
Yeah, I think well said. So we've reached the stage, Jenny, where we need to invite you to actually put a score on the proverbial door. What are you going to give this particular, I think one of the few autobiographies we've actually featured in terms of Book of the Month, what are you going to go for?
It's very well written. It's very evocative. I don't particularly like jazz myself. I enjoyed it. I'm going to give it an 8.
And I think it gets a solid 8.5 for myself. We'll find out what Rob Nichols is going to provide for it, I'm sure, somewhere along the system. Meanwhile, Jenny, we change genres, we change countries, we change writers, clearly, for the October Book of the Month, which is upcoming. What are we going to be looking at?
Well, I thought we needed something a little bit different and evocative of Halloween. So for October's book, we're going to read the first in a series of six books by Sergei Lukyanenko, and it's called The Night Watch. It's a cracker.
Good news. Technology has actually worked, and hopefully, fingers crossed, we can now, as promised, after Jenny has given her score, I've given my score, find out exactly what Rob Nichols thinks of the classic Peter Kerr autobiography, of course, Don't Call Me Clyde. Rob, you're not a trad jazz person. You are a musician, of course. You are very much connected with Shrug and so on and so forth. But what were your thoughts on this particular snapshot of music history?
It was a part of it, music history, that I was not aware of at all, really, Alex. People that he mentioned, like Chris Barber and Kenny Ball, you would often see on Pebble Mill at One or something like that. And they were a remnant from another age. And in fact, I saw Chris Barber 2 years ago at Middlesbrough Town Hall, when he was he was a great sort of veteran performer still. But amazing to hear about Stompermania that swept the country, and in a way that it sort of set the scene for a lot that happened in the 60s to 60s pop bands, in the way that there was somebody behind the scenes manipulating and well, exploiting the band. And they were playing gig after gig all over Britain, sometimes ridiculous, without Britain without the motorway network, from one sort of location, like hundreds of miles apart the next night, and exhausting themselves, doing loads of TV work and everything, and still living in sort of dire sort of circumstances. So it was really interesting to read about all those things, and quite sad for the band. And I think a forgotten sort of era of before the Beatles. And we heard a little bit about, they almost sort of, they rubbed shoulders with the Beatles a couple of times on those bills. And we know that there used to be an awful lot of acts used to play together in the early 60s. Or you know, places like the Globe in Stockton. So yeah, really interesting to think about the time between rock and roll in the '50s and Beatlemania in the '60s and Merseybeat and what followed.
Jenny made the point, of course, that jazz is one of those acquired tastes in so many ways, because unlike the apparent simplicity of skittle groups and rock and roll and so on, it is something which maybe is deemed to be a little bit more sophisticated. It tends to polarize people, much as opera does. I think, certainly being aware of Peter and the Wolf, acknowledging, obviously, the tune itself, I just really find it fascinating to see the way in which Peter actually really provides this snapshot. Because, as I said, I've known Peter for over a decade and a half, but more as a writer, as an author, and I knew a little bit about this, but this was a whole new aspect, which, as you said, Rob, certainly addresses something which sadly possibly still exists in certain instances, but it's the exploitation of the artist, in this case, by one of the artists themselves, as he actually decides to settle himself down in one of the Channel Islands. But something which, you know, clearly there was a disparity and an unfairness there in terms of the work that these guys are actually doing, the popularity they were actually having, and of course what we were actually seeing at the end of the day, because the general public, presumably, they were just a band that people like to dance to.
Yes, and if you recall, there was a couple of times when people were starting to question the fact that the band had the same name but a totally different personnel, and so, you know, it's very different to what came afterwards with Beatles and The Who and Rolling Stones, where you had the same faces all the way through. But the jazz scene, they're doing cover versions, aren't they, all the time? But they're doing their own improvisations of those songs. So in many respects, they're not going to get the royalties anyway, because they've not written that music. It's very, very different. And I enjoyed reading about the very roots of the band playing in like basically cowsheds, where hundreds of people would turn up in a tiny little village, a hamlet somewhere in the hills south of Edinburgh, and it was the big event of the weekend. And we're talking about a time when I don't know whether it's just after rationing or whether it's still in rationing, but we're talking about a time of real austerity, aren't we? And So where that weekend event is kind of really the central thing, and everyone gets very excited about it. So it definitely really good timing to get that snapshot of a forgotten era and a forgotten musical epoch. Mm.
Okay, difficult though this might be, I'm going to put the same question to yourself as I did to Jenny. Did you have any favourite characters in terms of the autobiography, in terms of how people were being portrayed and so on and so forth? Okay, so it's got to be Peter Kerr. He's obviously the guy who saved the band, kept it going and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think all the guys were really strong characters for playing night after night and in terrible circumstances, often, that they're digs. But they just all absolutely had a driving passion for the music. And I think some of his management behind the scenes were really quite positive and good guys, weren't they, in supporting Peter and the band, and in supporting, and even putting his picture on the wall in a club in London. But don't forget, I think we shouldn't forget Peter's family and his wife, who were really behind him at a time when obviously he'd given up a very secure and steady progression in the civil service, and that was an eye opener as well, wasn't it, Alex? He was the first person to have that opportunity of going in at a higher level in the civil service, and doing it purely on merit, and so he threw away a lot in a way, but it was great that his family still stayed behind him in that decision. But it was also, you know, That hadn't been possible before in the civil service. So we were seeing the start of something new there.
Maybe the onset of a form of meritocracy, which maybe people would say we still haven't reached fully effectively, but there we are. That's another line. Okay, your score, Rob.
I'm going to go for 8.5, Alex. 8.5 out of 10.
Which matches mine, spookily enough. And literally just 0.5 ahead of Jenny. So I think it's well into the good quality range of things there. Love to see this as a movie, which I think would be fascinating to actually see that being made. I think it cries out for a cinematic interpretation, as many Peter's over 17 books actually do. But I think in this particular one, it's intriguing because obviously we reviewed his tale told through the eyes of his sheepdog, of course, which again was a complete different eye. And I think certainly the talent that Peter exhibited as a jazz artist clearly actually echoes in his writing. Would you not agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think it would. I hadn't thought about that, but it would make a fascinating film, definitely.
Well, we'll simply wrap up by saying, Rob Nichols, huge thanks. We've got all the scores now. It's finally been put together. Book of the Month wrapped up. So keep on reading.